As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
With our top story, shall we? And a key question: is a global manufacturing slump putting a reality check on this weekend's trade truce? Across Asia and Europe, manufacturing PMIs sticking in contraction territory. For an original take, I would say, I'm pleased to say that joining us in the studio is Carl Weinberg, High Frequency Economics Chief Economist and Founder. Good morning to you, Carl.
Good morning, John.
I know you've got a different take on this. You think the PMIs through the year have been somewhat misleading. Just walk us through the thinking over high frequency at the moment, Carl.
Let's just take a deep breath, all right? Markets PMIs are new and they're not statistically tested. They can't be. They're only 12 years old. So to put full credit, to put full belief, confidence in what they're saying is a mistake. You really want to look at the trusted indicators, the ones that have been around for a long time, like Germany's IFO index, like the EC's, European Commission's economic confidence indices. And they've been signaling an economic downturn and an industrial downturn for over a year now. It's been right there for everyone to see. And market, meanwhile, has been above 50, and they've been saying, well, the economy's been growing, when the hard data are showing us that it's not. So industrial, to me at least, to our readers at High Frequency Economics, industrial recession in Europe is not news, all right? It's an ongoing story. It's not a problem. It's a fact. And the question we're talking about is, when is it going to end? And there's no sign of it from indices that we trust, like the IFO index, the European Economic Confidence Index, Japan. Tonkan out this morning, down. Right, it's been down for over a year now. All right, just have to look at the hard data and the surveys that are tested to see that that's been the case.
There has been somewhat of a divergence through various economies between what is happening with manufacturing and what is happening with services. Europe is a fantastic example of that. We haven't seen much side of a bleed through from a really soft manufacturing sector into a somewhat resilient services sector. What do you see at the moment, Carl?
Well, the risk, of course, is that services are to some extent dependent upon industry. All right, industry subcontracts out services, right? The big factory has a services company run its cafeteria and clean the factory floors, so that a downturn in industry is important, even though industry is only a relatively small part of the picture. So the question we're seeing right now is that growth overall is coming down. Employment growth is slowing. We'll be looking for that in releases this week from Europe. We saw a little bit of it in Japan last week. And we're looking for services to slow down in parallel with industry, bringing GDP down to a halt or possibly even a contraction.
Can monetary policy in its aloneness fix this?
In Europe, absolutely not, for a number of reasons. Reason number one is that the monetary stimulus that has been given to Europe by the ECB over the last 5 years has not been transmitted into the economy because banks aren't lending. Number two, monetary policy has stopped out. The ECB, despite Mr. Draghi's, I'll call it bluster, all right, has very few, if any, tools left available to use.
But critically, and Carl, this is where you're expert, is monetary policy stopped out across all of the Pacific Rim? I mean, forget about major players like Japan. Is it stopped out in Singapore? Look at the Australian shock over the weekend of the new low rates, John. In Australia, Italian two-year under 2% this morning. But is monetary policy stopped out in Australia or Singapore.
Nope, there are exceptions. Australia is certainly one of them, but even they're down to 1.25% on the cash rate, and their bond yields are at historic lows. You know, when you get bond yields down lower than they've ever been before, all right, you get them lower than inflation, you get borrowing rates below inflation, money is now free. And when money is free and the economy doesn't grow, you've sort of reached the limit as to what monetary policy can do. I think that the RBA governor, Philip Lowe, has joined voices with Mario Draghi, has joined voices with all the central bank governors saying it's time for fiscal policy to add something to this. Fiscal policy is the missing link.
Carl Weinberg, High Frequency Economics with us. This is with futures up 32, Dow futures up 253. How does an economist like you interpret a bull market in equities, the VIX 13.93? What's the prism of equity valuations that you see?
Well, what are the alternatives, Tom, right? You look at bond yields, right, and they're not very attractive. You go to Europe, and you have to pay the government to hold your money safely for a year or two or three or five, all right? You have negative interest rates. So the alternatives are not particularly attractive to equities right now. So a lot of money is just, it's a wall of money being funneled into it all.
So I think the key question for us, Tom, through the week is, are you willing, do you have the tolerance, the stomach to sit through and look through the weaker data that might come in the coming months? Do you have the stomach to sit through and look through the weaker revisions to earnings guidance that you may get in the coming months as well?
Starting with Jobs Day on Friday, the celebration of the colonies in the War of the Rebellion that happened in 1776 is on Thursday. I'll be working Friday. Are you in Friday?
I will be working Friday.
We're both here? Tag team?
It's Jobs Day.
It's Jobs Day. John Tucker, will you be here as Biscuit Demand?
Oh, absolutely.
We're all going to be here, folks, on Friday.
The payroll's Friday. So, Carl, let's talk about that. A lot of people are worried that in the coming months we will get worse data. We will get negative earnings revisions for some of these companies, some of the large mega caps here in the United States. Is that something you anticipate, something you set to see happening in the next coming months?
Well, the profit picture is complex, but certainly the macroeconomics don't seem to be supporting growth of profits. That's about as far as we can go at high frequency economics. On the employment side, all right, well, we have a very mixed picture in the United States right now, and this Friday's report has particularly big significance because we've got those bad numbers behind us, and the question is what kind of numbers lie ahead of us. The weakness in the labor market has not been confirmed by the weekly claims data, so our chief U.S. economist at High Frequency Economics, Jim O'Sullivan, is saying the jury is still out on what's really happening in the labor market, whether we've had some aberrational reports or whether we have a new trend. So we're watching, we will be watching not only the employment report, but also the weekly claims data.
160,000, John Farrell, is our Monday number on non-farm payrolls.
That's what we're
looking
for.
What's interesting, that'll get tweaked over the next couple days, a synthesis of 30 or 50, whatever the number of economists is. What do you think it comes down like to 155 from 160?
Look, we've been told again and again and again that we can't keep up the 200K month after month after month. But Carl, we've actually sustained a really decent pace of jobs growth in America. Is that something you can see continuing at the moment?
Well, you know, it can only continue so far. Of course, the unemployment rate has a three handle on it, and it can't go down forever. And this, of course, if we just take a deep breath and look backward, why did the Fed hike rates and tighten monetary conditions to begin with? It was because it was concerned that at the current rate of employment growth that we would run out of workers in a due course and lead to an inflation episode. So to some extent, a slowdown in growth and a slowdown in jobs is what the Fed really wanted to see. What's unexplicable right now, what we don't have a good story for, is why it's taking so long for wages to respond. And we're expecting a little bit of an uptick in the wages component, but not enough to keep the Fed happy.
Quick final question, Carl. Anything about the weekend that's changed anything for you and the team at High Frequency?
No, I mean, President Trump got what he wanted. You know, he got the talk started again. But the Chinese really gave up nothing, all right? It was total concession on the part of the U.S. Would they just agree to come back to the conversation?
What was it, 2 a.m. Saturday morning? I looked at my phone and said, I don't believe what I'm looking at.
Well, what were you looking at, all right? The Chinese agreed to come back to the table, all right? They were away from the table, all right? And Trump went there to ask them to come back to the table. All right. So when you have that dynamic, all right, the question is, what do you have to give up? So he gave up some degrees of freedom on tariffs. He gave up some of the restrictions on Huawei. And the Chinese said, OK, we'll come back to the
table. And we'll buy more soybeans.
But though he didn't, there's nothing specific. And the Chinese press has yet to report anything coming out of that meeting in terms
Thank you. This is an important interview for anybody on Global Wall Street, and we can dovetail it right into the Brookfield Genesee, Wyoming. That's real estate buying a train company. Robert Profusek does a quarterly visit with us. He is with Jones Day, but that barely describes his history of actual normal size transactions. I would go back, of course, to the important transaction of Continental and United. The airline business in America is all Bob Profusek's fault, and he joins us this morning. Explain the difference in your world of Jones Day to mega deals versus the actual deals that never make the headlines.
Well, there are a lot of deals in this last quarter in particular that didn't, that are not stillborn, I don't think. They're just not happening yet. And one of the thing that you've been talking about so much all morning about the uncertainty of everything, that's been the main factor. There's a fair amount of confidence. There's not a crisis of confidence, but there's a fair amount of concern among CEOs right now.
Yeah, with Chart of the Week last week, John, this is while you were gone on your sabbatical. Morgan Stanley with a chart of business confidence.
Yeah, I saw that.
Stunning.
I saw that. I saw the chart. I don't know what the inputs into the chart are, but we've seen the C-suite confidence on various survey indicators roll over. Bob, I know many investors that are struggling to make an investment decision with a time horizon longer than 5 seconds because of this trade story. How difficult is it right now for the C-suite to have the confidence to execute on a big transaction?
Well, it is difficult because on a big deal, companies and their directors certainly know that there's a potential for criticism. Look at Anadarko right now with what's going on with Occidental. And you're making long-term decisions in a difficult environment. Now, can people see through the fog of all this stuff? Sure, sometimes. And there are plenty of deals that were announced that have been well-received in the marketplace. But we're in a difficult environment right now. And so, you know, lots of directors are urging caution when CEO comes in and says, I got this great idea. But one thing is we shouldn't overlook that lots and lots of deals are still getting done. Lots of them. It's down on a year-on-year basis, but still, the market is very active right now.
There's always two extremes to every conversation. At one extreme, it's a C-suite that doesn't have the confidence to do anything. At the other extreme, Patrick Drahi slapping a 61% premium on Sotheby's, and a billionaire takes the public company private. This is already a company that is, by definition, quite toppy, and therefore this guy comes in and takes it private. And then some people, the lazy analysis here, and from me, from the outside looking in, the easy argument to construct is this feels toppy. Bob, is the truth just somewhere in between, that things are still okay and transactions are getting done?
Oh, sure. There's lots and lots of deals getting done. I haven't seen the numbers yet, but my guess was going in this weekend, a number of deals basis be down 15% for the first 6 months, something like that. But that's still on a base that's huge. There are 11,000-12,000 deals a year that get done. So it's not like, this isn't like 2009 or something like that,
right,
where there's no capital, there's no anything. It's just that people are more cautious.
Right.
It's like the equity markets.
This, Bob, here's a key question. If the Federal Reserve cuts interest rates, if borrowing costs go lower, does that change anything in the decision-making process of any of these guys?
Not really. It changes the math, and it makes modeling easier. I mean, like, you know, at 10 years at around, hovering around 200, as you mentioned, you know, that's almost free when you think about it. And the debt capital markets beyond the bank markets, you know, they were difficult at the year end when the equity markets were difficult, but they're great right now.
The desperation in healthcare seems unique. And I know it's, you know, Washington and legislation. No, there's Abbott Labs, AbbVie Pharmaceuticals, and Botox, whatever they took out. I can't remember the name right now.
Allergan,
excuse me. And there's Aetna and, you know, that whole blow up as well. Is it a rational industry right now? Is healthcare a rational business?
Well, it's a business that's got a lot of, you know, it's under a lot of pressure. It's in the vortex of politics. It's got all these things to deal with. Yet, you know, when you look at the contribution to the economy of this country, it's huge. It's a huge part of the economy.
Did you see I didn't know the name of Allergan because...
Are you pretending that you don't get Botox? You trying hard?
When you were gone on your sabbatical, this was a source of...
Can we just get this out of the way? Do you know how many people wrote to me last week and said, Tom keeps banging on about you being on vacation and it's giving you a really hard time? You've had more vacation than me this year. That was my first week off of the year.
Really?
That was my first week off of the year.
John Tucker, I would have never guessed that.
There's a Tom Keene Vacation Index.
Do you remember last summer when Tom missed every single payrolls Friday?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I did.
I do.
You skipped every payrolls Friday through the whole of summer.
Yeah, I just actually arranged things so that doesn't happen, including this Friday.
Now we've cleared things up. You can get back to your conversation.
Tell us about the law business right now. Are you having trouble retaining young Turks at Jones Day?
No, it really hasn't changed. The business is good. There's lots and lots of, the quality of the people coming out of
law school. Yeah. I hear it's stunning.
When I think about what I have been able to compete in that environment, I'm not
exactly. They all speak four languages,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and their resumes are fabulous. The law business, it's not like going to a startup tech company or something like that, but that's actually the benefit. It's stable. And when you come out of a big-time university with tons of debt, you can pay that down.
You can get gainfully employed and all that.
Yeah, it's a good business.
Tell us about the dynamic of Jones Day in Washington and all of legal in Washington. Is it gearing up for 2020? Is it stable? What's the dynamic among legal lobby in Washington right now?
Well, we don't participate in the political side of things. We don't have a lobbying practice per se. But, part of the hysteria of everything that goes on today, I guess it's borne by the media, offense, but it just gets in your face. There's tremendous amount of activity.
As you know, John, outside the St. Regis Bar in Washington, there's that long vertical room. It looks like an office at Jones Day.
You are responsible for hysteria in every single bar that you walk into.
That's true as well.
Have you ever been for a drink with Tom, Bob?
Actually, I've been once.
Yes. Yeah. Did it get messy quite quickly?
Yes.
I don't even try keeping up. Right. The drinks start coming and I stop. I just stop and then I walk away very quickly.
It's
an experience?
It's an experience, I would say.
Hey, Bob, thank you.
Thank you so much. Bob Profusek with us is a Q3. Look, so the summary I get here, Bob Profusek, is you've got some optimism into the second half, but boy, you got some distractions in Washington.
Yeah, that's right. We live in an environment where we're constantly bombarded by what's happening in these national capitals. It's just we're of course here, so we think about Washington, but it's not just Washington. Politics is in everything we're doing right now.
Okay. Bob Profusek, thank you so much.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Durable goods, I would suggest, is more important than usual on Wednesday.
Well, let's talk to Lindsay Piazza about it, shall we?
Dr. Stiefel's
chief economist.
Stiefel's chief economist. It's a blur of data, Lindsay, and we all agree this time is different. What is different about your day-to-day analysis this week of America's economy?
Well, I think it's increasingly important because we know the Fed is watching the data. And as they told us at the latest FOMC meeting, they're poised and ready to make a change in policy, but they're not yet convinced, meaning that they do acknowledge some of the weakness bubbling underneath the surface, but they'd really like to see more evidence of that slowdown. And so the Fed is going to be watching each and every data point that we get between now and the July meeting with increased scrutiny.
If we get, my father would call it a moldy number, if we get a really bad number, aren't they hugely advantaged to get out front with a rate cut immediately so they're not pressured with a 50 basis point foolishness the end of the month?
Well, They are, but at the same time, the Fed is not going to adjust policy based on one data point.
Agreed.
So they're going to be looking at the underlying trend. And has the trend in the data been deteriorating for quite some time? I would argue yes, but Fed officials don't quite seem as convinced as I am, or
well,
certainly not as convinced as the market is.
John, on your sabbatical, we did have some constructive data points on income and spending. I mean, they weren't bang up, but... To
That's
the
good.
Fed's point, there's been a few constructive data points.
So I've spoke to some people at Morgan Stanley recently, Lindsay, and one thing they worry about is corporate margins and how companies will respond to the threat of smaller corporate margins and whether they'll pull the lever that says cut the labor force. Lindsay, are you seeing any sign of that happening at the small and medium-sized company level? Any signs of job cuts starting to emerge in this economy?
Oh, I think all we need to look at is last month's employment report, and there's very clear indication that businesses are having an increased difficult time passing on increases in costs directly onto the consumer. And so they're having to circumvent a lot of that pressure by finding ways to reduce costs at home, meaning find those cost efficiencies, in many cases, meaning layoffs or lower wages or both. And I do think that this is going to be an ongoing trend that we continue to see, particularly if we don't see the latest in trade negotiations actually pan out into an extended truce or some
right.
sort of long-term agreement. At 10%, businesses were able to eat that cost increase.
Right.
At 25%, this is going to be increasingly difficult.
Lindsay, walk us through durable goods. I say this because I think durable goods and inventories are what I would call secondary or indeed tertiary market economic data points that no one cares about until they do care about it. Right now is one of those times. Walk us through how you interpret these longer than 3-year goods in America.
Well, I think durable goods investment is always an important indication. It's certainly from a corporate standpoint, but I would say that we really need to get into the weeds when we're looking at the durable goods.
Well,
report.
The get into the weeds.
Yes, is important, but we really need to look at durable goods ex transportation, so excluding aircraft production, and that is a proxy. That's a proxy for corporate investment when we look at that isolated component. And what we see is that corporations, yes, are still investing. But again, when we look at capital goods, excluding aircraft and defense, I should say, this really gives us an underlying sense of whether or not businesses are willing to invest. And we continue to see this very minimally positive trend. So again, corporate dollars still being put to work, but this really highlights a hesitancy and a really heightened level of uncertainty when we look at the longer-term trajectory for the economy. When businesses are feeling confident, when they're happy about the growth prospects of the economy or their particular sector, they're very willing to loosen those corporate purse strings and put capital to work. On the flip side, when they're not confident and they're concerned about the prospects for the U.S. economy, they pull back. And what we have been seeing is very minimally positive months of investment or outright negative business investment.
Right.
So this is something also that the Fed is watching
yeah.
at. If corporations aren't investing, they're not hiring. Right.
Thank you for the briefing. Dr. Piazza with Stifel this morning.
Tech stocks are rallying before the market opens here. We had some, on the news coming out of Osaka that perhaps the U.S. and China will be going back to the negotiating
perhaps.
Table. That helps our good friends out in Silicon Valley, particularly the guys at Apple Computer, the folks at Apple. Dan Ives is a managing director covering all things TMT for FBR Capital Markets. And Dan, just give us a sense. First of all, thanks so much for joining us, but give us a sense of what you think this could mean for Apple, because Apple's kind of been, I guess, the poster child for tech regulation or tech tariffs.
Yeah, they're the poster child, especially in the U.S.-China trade battle. And, the street, there's a mini yelling fire in a crowded theater. And I'd say about $2 of earnings has almost been taken off the street's whisper number. And I think when you look at what happened, this is a Goldilocks scenario for Apple. And we believe ultimately it could add about $20 per share to the name over the coming months if the China ultimately ends up the bark's worse than the bite.
So it's interesting when you think about Apple and the tariff scenario, they kind of got hit by a double whammy, i.e. they sell almost 20% of their revenue comes from China, plus they manufacture the phones and the pads and the, all that kind of stuff in China. So, you know, it really was a big issue for them. So how do you think they're going to kind of adjust to what might be easing discussions here? Are they going to turn back kind of their let's build stuff outside of China scenario?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, that's sort of the key. I mean, we believe that was a poker game. And ultimately, even best case, 5 to 7% production could go to an India or Vietnam in the next 18 months. If the $325 billion of tariffs never happen, they do not move one iPhone out of China. And ultimately, I think they could even double down there, as you're seeing with Mac production now moving to China. So that's key on the supply chain, on the demand side. I think the street is still a glass half empty in terms of what's going to come out of China from the demand perspective. Is there a pro-Huawei, yeah, almost nationalistic view? So that's why right now we believe this is a major step in the right direction, still more wood to chop.
With all the gloom on Apple, is it a gloom where they lose market share, or is it an industry softness? Which is it?
I think right now the smartphone industry, you've seen it go into maturity. And I think right now the question for Apple is, can that incremental growth come out of China? Look, 20% of iPhones over the next 12 to 18 months are going to come out of China. So I think partially it's Apple specific, but then there is a broad view of the sector.
Right.
And that's why right now for them, services is key to that value.
Okay, but
we believe here.
But Dan, what's so important here is what I'll call margin elasticity. Do they have the ability to manipulate on unit and price to maintain margins, even if there is a China slowdown?
Well, if there's a significant China slowdown, it definitely is going to hurt them. But I do think they have flexibility from a price perspective in, yeah, China to stimulate demand. And for a company that generates $60 billion in free cash flow, they have that flexibility. And that's right now what investors are focused,
right,
on when it comes to China.
Well said. And Paul Sweeney, this is incredibly important because I think to a lot of our listeners, they don't understand, I don't understand, the mix, as they say in the conference calls, between unit sales and price. And always that's a mystery, isn't it?
Yeah, particularly now that Apple doesn't disclose the unit sales like they used to. So guys, folks like Dan Ives, you know, makes their job a little bit more difficult. So Dan, one of the issues that I think investors had with this whole trade tension issue and tariff issue is that the Huawei risk for Apple, i.e. that China puts Apple on some blacklist and that really would impact Apple. Do you think that is off the table or still on the table?
Yeah, we continue to look. That was a conspiracy theory where you're going to see people in the streets putting iPhones on fire, which we thought was never going to happen. And now that basically gets put to rest in our opinion, which is that's the first step. Next step is obviously no tariffs, and then it comes down to demand. That's why if you're Tim Cook last night, you're popping the champagne.
It's interesting. Do you think Apple's still going to move ahead with, you know, maybe greater urgency on contingency plans, even if we don't have an issue in the near term? It seems like this might be a long-term risk for Apple and other tech players.
Look, I think they have essentially bet the farm with Foxconn in China. And given the supply chain, when you look at Vietnam or India or Brazil, that is not a good alternative for them. They might take 2-3% and put it into other countries. But realistically, for now,
yeah,
I would equate how Apple views it as no different than Ford or GM moving out of Detroit if they ever moved out of China.
Give us your price target, Dan Ives, again on Apple. I just want to get that.
Yeah, 235 price target, and we continue to think this is a name that has significant upside here.
Thanks so much. Dan Ives Weeden with us today on Apple. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons. This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.